Well, Matt, and welcome to episode 148, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March the 19th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we kick off our discussion of Coriolanus with a plot synopsis and an introduction of sorts, plus a brush with greatness and a birthday wish. But first, Coriolanus. The first act of Coriolanus, and it's a fairly long one, longer than average, with more scenes, 10, than any other play, begins on a street in Rome with a company of mutinous citizens with staves, clubs, and other weapons. That's a pretty detailed stage direction for Shakespeare, though these stage directions have become more explicit as we've moved through the canon. And what are all of these citizens so mutinous about? Why are they resolved rather to die? Well, the answer is in the finish of that resolved sentence, famish. It seems that the Roman citizenry are starving, and if there's someone to blame, it seems, then that someone is Caius Marcius, chief enemy of the people. And who is this enemy, this Caius Marcius? Why, only the man who will become, before the end of this play, called Coriolanus. As the scene progresses, it appears that the citizens have gathered to storm a grain warehouse. They're doing this in hunger for bread, not thirst for revenge. They want to go after Marcius because, despite his services he has done for his country, he pays himself with being proud. Our hero has done good service for his country, but because he's proud, the citizenry wants to kill him. The citizenry is not looking too good at this point. Menenius Agrippa arrives, and though he's another patrician and a friend to Marcius, he's seen as one that hath always loved the people. Agrippa attempts to state the patrician's case, giving the citizens an allegory in which the state is a body and its parts are all different groups of people. By the end, he's telling the citizens that they've been led by a great toe. Upon this insult, Marcius arrives, and he berates them as well. He also tells Agrippa that if the Senate would let him use his sword, he would slaughter these citizens, stacking the quartered slaves as high as he could pick his lance. And Marcius is not looking too good right about now either. We hear that the Senate, however, has granted the citizens some protection slash quasi-representation in the form of tribunes. Then word arrives that the enemy Volscian army is in the field. Marcius praises their leader Aufidius, for whom Marcius sins in envying his nobility. Envy, yes, but wants to kill him too. When Marcius and the citizens leave the stage, two of the new tribunes remain to complain about Marcius, saying that he gets far too much credit for what he does. In Act 1, Scene 2, we're taken to the Senate, but not of Rome, but of Coriolis, a major town in Volsca. The senators are meeting with Aufidius, the leader of the Volscan army, whom Marcius wants to fight. News has arrived that three Roman battalions are heading to Volsca, led by Cominius, Marcius, and Titus Larcius. Aufidius states his hope to meet Marcius in the field. Act 1, Scene 3 takes us back to Rome, but this time to the home of Marcius, where we meet his mother, Volumnia, and wife, Virgilia. Volumnia tries to cheer a worried Virgilia by telling her of her mother's pride and the pleasure to see him seek danger where he was like to find fame. When Virgilia asks how Volumnia would have felt if he had died, Volumnia responds, "Then his good report should have been my son." Damn, guess we know how Marcius became the badass he's become. Volumnia goes on to fantasize of Marcius's defeat of Aufidius. Even with a bloody brow, the blood more becomes a man than guilt his trophy. A friend of Volumnia, Valeria, and what is it with all these V's, comes in to see her friend and to tell her of Marcius's son playing with a butterfly until he mammocked and tore it to pieces. Volumnia responds by saying something along the lines of, like father, like son. Oh, and the friend's got some other news. Cominius and his army are contending with a part of the Volscan army, while Marcius and Larcius have headed down to Coriolis. The next scene takes us to the gate of that town where Martius and Lartius and their army call the senators of Caryellus for a parley, whom inform them that the rest of the Volscian army, led by Aufidius, is on its way to take on the Romans. The Volscians enter, and the Romans are beaten back. Martius curses his soldiers, belittling them. "You souls of geese that bear the shapes of men." He even threatens to fight them before calling on them to follow him into battle again. Henry V, this guy isn't. Through the gate they go, wartime chaos continues, and Martius returns bleeding and assaulted by the enemy. The scene ends with all of the soldiers entering the city. Act 1, Scene 5 begins with Roman soldiers carrying off their spoils of war, seemingly victorious. That still bleeding Martius enters, and is none too happy to see this, especially as there are other battles to be won, especially against the man of Martius's soul's hate, Aufidius, who is winning his battle against the Romans. Act 1, Scene 6 takes us to the Roman camp, where Cominius hears words of the battle, but only up to the point where the Romans were driven back. The reason why the news is so slow, as if those in the audience were wondering, is because spies of the Volsces held the messenger in chase, causing him to have to go out of his way. But then Martius arrives, asking, "Come I too late?" spoiling for more fight. He delivers the news to them that Lartius is holding Caryellus in the name of Rome, and then in language that harkens back to Henry V, whom you might recall I said Martius most definitely did not resemble in battle, he speaks of Lartius holding down the town like greyhounds on the leash about to slip. Martius asks how the battle is going here. The news is exactly what Martius wants to hear. The Volscian army, with a vanguard of soldiers from Actium, is still in the field, led by Aufidius. And off he goes, followed by those soldiers who love this painting, blood, wherein they see Martius smeared, think brave death outweighs bad life. The next short scene has Lartius leaving Caryellus with a small holding army, as he leads the larger troops in the battle, warning the lieutenant to send the holding army and abandon the city if he calls for help. At the beginning of Act 1, Scene 8, Martius and Aufidius meet on the field of battle. They trade insults, then blows. Then, much to Aufidius's dismay and shame, members of his own army come in and pull him from battle. In Act 1, Scene 9, the scene turns to the Roman victory party, where Cominius praises Martius's exploits in battle. Martius arrives to chime in as well. Martius, despite what the citizenry had said before about his arrogance and pride, and despite his own harsh words to his own soldiers in battle, responds modestly, saying, "I have done as you have done. That's what I can." Cominius continues to praise Martius, saying how all Rome must know the value of their own, and offering him the victorious general's common distribution of 1/10 of the spoils. Martius refuses and proclaims a hope for the end of the war. Cominius then announces, "For what he did before Caryellus, call him, with all the applause and clamor of the host, Caius Martius Coriolanus." And that's how we get the title. Martius reluctantly agrees, then asks that a poor man, in whose house Martius found kindness, and who had been taken prisoner by the Romans, be found so that the man may be released. Only Martius has forgotten the man's name. And gee, I really hope this is one of those cases where Shakespeare begins a storyline and then forgets it, because if it isn't, I have a feeling this isn't going to end well. The final scene of the act takes place at the Volscian camp, where Aufidius and a soldier lament the loss of Caryellus and continue to state their hatred of Martius. And thus, the first act of Coriolanus ends. Act 2 of Coriolanus takes us back to Rome, where Menenius and the two plebeian tribunes, Brutus and Sicinius, discuss the latest news of Coriolanus's victory, with the patrician praising him and the two tribunes continuing to complain about him. Coriolanus's mother and wife appear. Volumnia, dear old mom, seems thrilled by Coriolanus's war wounds. "Oh, he is wounded. I thank the gods for it." She proudly boasts of his war scars. "Now counting 27, every gash was an enemy's grave." Coriolanus arrives to great fanfare and his renaming. Coriolanus, embarrassed by it, stops them and then is reunited with his mother. Menenius is thrilled to have Coriolanus back as well. Coriolanus says goodbye to his mother and wife, a woman he never addresses in the scene. Even his mom's friend gets a weird hello. "And live you yet, oh my sweet lady, pardon." And he goes off with his train, leaving the plebeians, tribunes, Brutus and Sicinius, to complain about him again. Much of it sounds like envy until they get to the self-preservation portion of their complaints. If he becomes consul, their office may, during his power, sleep. And they begin to plot against him, exchanging lies they will tell to the people. We must suggest the people in what hatred he still hath held them. Well, maybe that isn't a lie exactly, but there is nothing like that that's voiced in the scene before our audience's ever-loving ears. But the tribunes have to hurry. A messenger returns with news that Coriolanus will become consul if the people thus far get their say. I have seen the dumb men throng to see him and the blind to hear him speak. Matrons flung gloves, ladies and maids their scarves and handkerchiefs upon him as he passed. The nobles bended as to Jove's statue and the commons made a shower and a thunder with their caps and shouts. Act 2, Scene 2 takes us to the Capitol and the Senate House. Two officers discuss the events in Rome and Coriolanus's possible rise to consul. Coriolanus enters with some patricians and tribunes who begin to discuss honoring the returning hero. Brutus says that he is willing to honor Coriolanus if he remember a kinder value of the people than he hath hereto prized them at. There's not much support for Brutus at this point, but Coriolanus offers to leave anyway, saying it's just because he doesn't want to hear them recount his bravery, not for anything that Brutus has said. But then Coriolanus says, "But your people, I'd love them as they weigh," and leaves anyway. In his absence, the consul Cominius makes a convincing case for Coriolanus, and they decide to make him consul. Coriolanus thanks the Senate upon his return, but begins an attempt to get out of the custom of speaking to the people, showing his wounds and asking them for their vote. He finally agrees to do it, and after Coriolanus and the train of senators leave, again we get the two plebeian tribunes who talk about how they're going to go to the people and get them to go against Coriolanus. In Act 2, Scene 3, citizens begin to gather in the forum ready for Coriolanus's arrival. They seem to be leaning against voting for Coriolanus, but that they will vote for him as befits the custom. So, if he tells us of his noble deeds, we must also tell him our noble acceptance of them. Ingratitude is monstrous. The more they talk, however, the more they begin to want to demand respect from Coriolanus. When he enters in a gown of humility, they exit, allowing him private time to state again his discomfort at the ritual and open disdain for the people. Hang 'em! I would they would forget me like the virtues which our divines lose by 'em. He says this to his mentor Menenius, who cautions Coriolanus from speaking out against the custom or the people who come to ask him. Menenius exits, and three citizens return to talk to Coriolanus. He begins with short answers, saying he is there for his own deserving, not for his desire. But as the interview goes on, he becomes less and less civil, and says he will show his scars only in private. While this could be seen as an embarrassment or humility, it's still a breach in the custom. Amazingly, though, they agree to vote for him. When the next pair of citizens enters, the situation worsens. When one citizen complains that Coriolanus has not indeed loved the common people, he responds that the citizenry should account him the more virtuous, that he hath not been common in his love. And despite that, he refuses again to show his scars to them, but yet they too agree to support him for consul. When they leave, he curses the custom, but resigns himself to it. Menenius and the two plebeian tribunes re-enter to announce it appears that all has gone well, and that Coriolanus can now go to the Senate for his approbation. He and Menenius exit, and when the citizens re-enter, Brutus and Sicinius begin to turn their lukewarm support for Coriolanus to cold disdain. The citizens realize Coriolanus was not confirmed. We may deny him yet. Brutus and Sicinius continue to rile up the citizens, convincing them that he's your fixed enemy. When the citizens leave, the tribune gloat on how they've turned the citizenry to mutiny and goaded them onward, then predict that Coriolanus will respond with rage. And thus, Act 2 of Coriolanus ends. Act 3 of Coriolanus begins on a Roman street. Coriolanus, Menenius, patricians, and senators enter, discussing the military movements of the Volscians led by Aufidius, who we learn is bitter against his own people for yielding the city of Carilius to then Marcius, now Coriolanus. Aufidius now lives in Antium, Coriolanus wishes he had a cause to seek him there. Coriolanus tells Lartius of his hate for the entering Brutus and Sicinius, the plebeians' tribunes, and this when he has no idea of what they've done to him yet. The tribunes stop Coriolanus from entering the capital, as it is dangerous. They announce that the people are now incensed against him. When Coriolanus says that this is some kind of plot, Brutus says that this is all because Coriolanus mocked the people. Despite Menenius's pleas for Coriolanus to calm himself, Coriolanus rages, and it only gets worse. Claims and counterclaims escalate until the tribunes finally state that Coriolanus has spoken like a traitor and shall answer as traitors do. The plebeians arrive with police, and they attempt to arrest Coriolanus. Cominius and Menenius convince Coriolanus to go back to his home. Once he's gone, Menenius attempts to calm the crowd to no avail. While the tribunes and the plebeians want to pursue Coriolanus, Menenius convinces them to at least allow him to try to bring Coriolanus back. The second scene of the act takes us to Coriolanus' home, where his family attempts to calm the raging general. His mother, Volumnia, attempts comfort. "Oh, sir, 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 I would have you had put your power well on before you had worn it out." Then reason. "I have a heart as little apt as yours, but yet a brain that leads my use of anger to better vantage." And then chiding. "Come all to ruin. Let thy mother rather feel thy pride than fear thy dangerous stoutness." Finally, this convinces Coriolanus to return to the forum and meet with his accusers and answer them mildly. The third and last scene of the third act returns to the forum where the plebeian tribunes plan to accuse Coriolanus of desiring tyrannical power, and begin to orchestrate how they will manipulate the people at the meeting later with Coriolanus and push the general to collar. Coriolanus enters with Menenius and Cominius and states that he is content to let the proceeding go on. The plebeians enter. Menenius tells those in attendance to consider further that when Coriolanus speaks not like a citizen, you find him like a soldier. Sicinius accuses Coriolanus of being a traitor to the people, and whatever calm Coriolanus might have had evaporates. The tribunes and the plebeians then banish Coriolanus, who gives them quite the kiss-off. "You common cry of curs whose breath I hate, as reek of the rotten fens whose loves I prize, as the dead carcasses of unburied men that do corrupt my air, I banish you, and here remain with your uncertainty. Let every feeble rumor shake your hearts. Your enemies, with nodding of their plumes, fan you into despair, have the power still to banish your defenders, till at length your ignorance, which finds not till it feels, making but what reservation of yourself still your own foes, deliver you, as most abated captives, to some nation that won you without blows. Despising for you the city, I thus turn my back. There is a world elsewhere." And with that, he exits, and the third act concludes. Act 4 of Coriolanus begins at the gates of Rome, where the newly banished Coriolanus is saying goodbye to his family and friends. Well, actually, his first speech is directed only to his mother. When his wife responds, "Oh heavens, oh heavens," Coriolanus completes the antilab with, "Nay, I prithee, woman," before he is interrupted by his mother, and then he responds to Volumnia again. Virgilia doesn't seem to have Coriolanus's ear quite like the way Volumnia does. Coriolanus is convinced he shall be loved when he is lacked. He delivers personalized farewells to Cominius, Menenius, and his mother again, relegating his wife to a mere "my wife" reference. Volumnia asks for and gets an agreement from Cominius to escort Coriolanus, but her son refuses, saying again goodbye, and with what I'm sure is supposed to be gallows humor, "While I remain above ground, you shall hear from me still." It might be gallows humor, but it's still a little foreboding. Act 4, Scene 2 takes us back into Rome, where the two plebeian tribunes, Brutus and Sicinius, gloat over their shown power, getting ready to send the people home as their great enemy is gone. Volumnia, Virgilia, and Menenius enter, having returned from saying farewell, and the two women accost the tribunes who attempt to leave. Menenius attempts to keep the peace, and the tribunes escape, only to have Volumnia proclaim, "Anger's my meat, I sup upon myself. She wants blood for what has been done to her son. Meanwhile, on the road to Antium, two soldiers meet, a Roman and a Volscian. They remember a previous meeting and discuss the state of Rome. The Roman announces the banishment of Coriolanus from Rome and says to his Volscian friend that Aufidius will appear well in these wars, his great opposer Coriolanus being now in no request of his country. The Volscian says that he will deliver this news personally to Aufidius and invites the Roman to come along. And he does, intimating that he will help the Volscian army attack Rome. Needless to say, Nicanor the Roman is not a plebeian. Near Aufidius' house in Actium, Act 4, Scene 4, shows Coriolanus and his arrival in Antium. He asks a citizen to help him find Aufidius' house, and before it, in, if I'm not mistaken, the first and last soliloquy of the play, Coriolanus muses on the world's slippery turns and says of his upcoming meeting with Aufidius, if he slay me, he does fair justice. If he give me way, I'll do his country service. He is ready to join the enemy. In the next scene, in Aufidius' house, Coriolanus makes his way past bickering serving men and presents himself to Aufidius, who at first doesn't recognize him. Coriolanus has no choice but to announce, my name is Caius Martius, who hath done to thee particularly, and to all the Volsces, great hurt and mischief. Thereto witness may my surname, Coriolanus. I present my throat to thee and to thy ancient malice, which not to cut would show thee but a fool, since I have ever followed thee with hate. Drawn turns of blood out of thy country's breasts, and cannot live but to thy shame, unless it be to do thee service. Now, given this is Act 4, Aufidius, who remember hates Coriolanus, doesn't cut the Roman's throat and end the play. No, instead he twines his arms about Coriolanus' body. Yes, Aufidius gives his enemy a hug and welcomes him into the Volscian fold. In fact, Aufidius will give Coriolanus one half of his army, one half of his command, and since Coriolanus knows his country's strength and weakness, Aufidius will work with him to defeat Rome. If you're thinking, what the hell? You're not alone. When the soldiers leave, one of the serving men states, here's a strange alteration. No kidding. The sixth scene of the fourth act takes us back to Rome, where the plebeian tribunes are still celebrating their political and deceitful victory over Coriolanus. We see Menenius greet them respectfully, and citizens hail them. Then word arrives that the Volscians are sending two separate armies toward Rome. Menenius is sure this is because Aufidius, hearing of Martius's banishment, is taking advantage and attacking when he perceives Rome is in a military weakness. But then comes word of Martius's joining with Aufidius, and that he's leading one of the Volscian armies heading towards Rome. Word travels fast, and Cominius enters, and both he and Menenius rail against the two tribunes and their good work. The tribunes aren't celebrating now, and it only gets worse for them when a band of citizens arrive to complain that it was the tribune's idea to banish Coriolanus. The people show regret for what they've done, but not the tribunes, who simply do not like this news. The seventh and last scene of this act takes place in the Volscian camp of Aufidius near Rome. More and more of the Volscian army are joining with Coriolanus, and Aufidius's reputation is darkened by this action. Aufidius seems taken aback, not only by his troops' actions, but by those of Coriolanus himself. He bears himself more proudly, or even to my person, than I thought he would when I first did embrace him. Yet for the moment, Aufidius is willing to use Coriolanus to defeat Rome. But he does have an end game in mind. One fire drives out one fire. One nail, one nail. Rights by rights founder, strengths by strengths do fail. Come, let's away. When, Caius, Rome is thine, thou art poorest of all, then shortly art thou mine. And on that ominous note, can Coriolanus trust no one save his dear old mom? Act 4 of Coriolanus ends. Act 5 of Coriolanus begins with the tribunes attempting to convince Menenius to go and talk to Coriolanus in an attempt to save Rome from destruction. Menenius refuses, as Cominius has already tried and failed. But after much discussion, he agrees. Menenius leaves, but Cominius still feels that all hope is vain unless his noble mother and his wife, who, as I hear, mean to solicit him. In Act 5, Scene 2, we see Menenius arrive at the Volscian camp and be rebuffed by the watchman. When an argument ensues, Coriolanus and Aufidius enter to see what is going on. Menenius makes his plea to Coriolanus, trying to build a stronger connection with the general, calling him my son and himself thy old father. It doesn't work, and Coriolanus turns him away, saying, wife, mother, child, I know not. But because he once loved the old man, he sends the old patrician home with a letter. Next, Coriolanus and Aufidius discuss how Coriolanus is withstanding these pleas from Rome. Coriolanus admits that sending away Menenius cracked his heart. Imagine then his turmoil, when he is then visited by his mother, wife, son, and attendants. First, Virgilia attempts to talk to him, and then his mother, Volumnia, who even uses her grandson as a prop for her requests. Coriolanus still refuses. Volumnia tells her son that if he continues his attack on Rome, he will end up literally killing his family. When the general attempts to leave, Volumnia makes one last push. If he calls a truce, then the Volscians can take credit for mercy, and the Romans can thank them for it. She and the family kneel before Coriolanus. The general is taken aback. He wants to frame a convenient peace, yet he asks Aufidius what he would do if he was in Coriolanus's place. The Volscian admits, I was moved with all. With this answer, Coriolanus calls for the truce to be made, but says that he will not return to Rome, but will rather stay with Aufidius. In an aside, Aufidius says that he is glad that Coriolanus has sued for peace, as it will allow him to work himself a former fortune. In Act 5, Scene 4 in Rome, Menenius speaks with Sicinius, one of the plebeian tribunes, without much hope, as there is no more mercy in Coriolanus than there is milk in a male tiger. And then messages begin to flow in. Brutus, the other plebeian tribune, has been captured by the plebeians, who swear that if the Roman ladies bring not comfort home, that both tribunes will face death at the hands of the people. And then there's news that the ladies have prevailed, followed by a general shout of joy. In the fifth scene of the act, and the penultimate of the play, a senator welcomes home the women as if they have triumphed in war. They are heroines. In Act 5, Scene 6, the last of the play, we return to Coriolis, where Aufidius prepares to have Coriolanus brought before the people. At this point, the stage directions say it all. Enter three or four conspirators of Aufidius's faction. They say that if Aufidius do still hold the same intent as when he sought them, they are ready. Aufidius says that he will let the people decide. He laments that Coriolanus has spared Rome over a few drop of women's tears. Lords of Volsca enter, unhappy with the truce. Aufidius says that they will be heard. Coriolanus enters, hails the lords, senators, and commoners, and states his love for his new nation. He has returned with spoils to deliver to the Senate. And it is this point that Aufidius calls Martius, because he will not use the stolen name Coriolanus, a traitor for sparing Rome without taking counsel of his generals. While some of the lords call for calm, the conspirators call for Coriolanus's death, and the people follow suit. The conspirators then draw their swords and kill Coriolanus. The lords are shocked and angry with Aufidius, who answers them, my lords, when you shall know the great danger which this man's life did owe you, you'll rejoice that he was thus cut off. And as they take his body away, Aufidius claims to be struck with sorrow and says that Coriolanus shall have a noble memory. And thus the play ends. And I can't help but feel just a little cynical and queasy about all this. Coriolanus. Well, I've never seen this on stage. I've seen the Ralph Fiennes film, and it was pretty damn good. More on that next week. But there's a strangeness to this play, you know, with its not exactly likable hero. I can kind of see why it's not performed frequently. I mean, how do you market that guy? Then you've got a kind of tripartite antagonist in the people, the tribunes, and Aufidius. And a weird mix of military and politics, possible psychoanalytic and Marxist, hell, even feminist readings. Its weirdness harkens back to Troilus and Cressida, and I'm not so sure that's a good thing. On the flip side, there's much in the play to like, at least from my point of view. From a purely literary perspective, there's a great many neat callbacks to other plays. Its structure is interesting in that we don't just build to a battle at the end. The more full-fledged military scenes come in the first half of the play. And its political critique, you might even call it satire, is crisp. And then there's Volumnia. We finally get a Shakespearean mother. And what a mother she is. So, after this first read, I'm fascinated. Fascinated, but pretty ambivalent. I'm not sure I like it, but I do know I can't wait for a deeper dive. Need some teaching resources? Need to adorn your teaching materials with some Shakespearean goodies? Well, check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the teacherspayteachers.com site. We've got materials on Romeo and Juliet, Julius Caesar, King Lear, Othello, Troilus and Cressida, and Titus Andronicus, with more on the way all the time. Plus, you can find the handout version of the periodic table of Shakespeare. Now, some are free, some are for purchase, but all quality items. And for those of you who are asking for bigger, poster-sized versions of that periodic table, you can order those from our Redbubble page. Links to both pages can be found in the navigation of this here website.
Okay, so a couple of nights back, I had the coolest Shakespeare geek experience. On Monday night, my wife Lisa, son Kyle, and I went to Patton Oswalt's Levity Live stand-up show in Oxnard, and since we got there early, we were right up against the stage. Now, during the first half of the show, he was talking to some members of the audience, and he asked me what I did, and made a little fun out of how geeky my answer, write a little code, do some blogging, was. Then he asked me what I blogged about, and when I said Shakespeare, the geek flag flew. He asked me what play I was blogging about now, Coriolanus, and he talked about the plot and the recent Ralph Fiennes film. Asked me what was next, I said Cymbeline. He didn't know much about that, but then again, who does? Asked me what my favorite was. I said Titus Andronicus, and he went off on a whole riff on what a freak show the play is, recounting some of the weird violence in the play and saying that it must have been some kind of patron request. I want a rape, some chopped off hands, and if you could mix in a little cannibalism, that'd be nice. And then he asked me if I'd seen the Hopkins film. At one point during all of this, he even turned to the audience and something to the effect of, "You can all go, we're just going to talk Shakespeare here." That, my friends, is Shakespeare geek nirvana. Patton Oswalt is just freaking awesome. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries since our last regular, i.e., non-interview special podcast, you've missed out on subjects including Pericles, the wrap-up, a new month, a new play, Coriolanus, Coriolanus Act 1, Part 1, battle lines drawn and crossed, last chance to see much ado, Coriolanus Act 1, Part 2, a victory and a name bestowed, Coriolanus authorship, much ado about something ending, Coriolanus Act 2, in a dislikability contest, everyone loses. Coriolanus sources, go north, old man. Coriolanus Act 3, this is not going to end well. Podcast 147, interview special, Melissa Chalsma and David Melville of Independent Shakespeare Company, Part 2. YouTube update, Coriolanus. Coriolanus Act 4, the world takes a slippery turn. The Bill Shakespeare Project, Brush with Greatness, Patton Oswalt. Coriolanus Act 5, backstabbers and front stabbers too. And looky looky, you know what this means, hint, it might become periodical. So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions or just one daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you ever have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast when we'll dive deeper into Coriolanus. Hope to see you then. Listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March the 19th, 2017. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon. Hey, if you're still listening out there, tomorrow is my wife Lisa's birthday. Love you, babe. You keep me sane and, well, you just keep me sane. Thanks, and I love you truly.